You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome to today's episode of Off the Shelf. I'm Pete Sox, your host, the Catholic Book Blogger. And in a few minutes, we're going to have with us Vivian Doudreau, the editor of the book Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, The Secrets of Christmas and Epiphany by Grzegorz Górny. And I probably butchered that name, but it's Polish and I don't necessarily know how to pronounce it. So we'll call him Mr. Górny for the rest of this segment until Vivian comes on and tells me how to pronounce it correctly. But this book's from Ignatius Press. And what a book it is. I was really impressed with this book, and I was really excited that I could get Vivian on today to talk about it. And what it is, it's a kind of a, I don't know how to describe it best, but I'll use a word, maybe like a National Geographic book of Catholicism, based on the Three Magi. And the reason I say that is this book is hardcover, and it's packed with photos and art, and it's just... the artwork itself is just so beautiful, but the book is very valuable. What it does is, Górny looks at the three kings, the three magi, the very mysterious three magi, who are only mentioned briefly in the book of Matthew. We don't know much about them. We don't need, you know, and Vivian and I will talk about this soon, but, you know, the validity of this story, what evidence is there that there were three magi. And there's plenty. There's plenty of evidence that this is true. And that's what Górny gets into in this book. You know, he looks at discoveries made by historians, by scientists, and theologians, and he answers the question of, you know, were they real? Did they come? How far east did they come? You know, what gifts do they really bring, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of questions about the three wise men, but, you know, study of history shows that they have a place in history. History shows that there were men that had the title Magi. And also, you know, there's the story about the whole following the stars. Is that possible? Well, yeah, it is possible because Magi were astrologists, and they studied the stars. We're going to get into all that with Vivian. I'm sure it's going to be a great talk, and I can't wait to have her come on, and we can discuss that more. But after I read this book, I went back and discovered that Ignatius Press has, this is his fourth title, and these books are translated from their original Polish, so... these are being translated for us into English. And all of them are illustrated in the same manner, but I discovered that he has they're all mystery related. So it's kind of cool, kind of an unsolved mysteries type theme to these books. And it really makes them attractive. The one book, and I don't know what order these were released in, so I'm just going to tell you what they are. The first book that I found was Witnesses to Mystery, and it's Investigation into Christ's Relics. And what it is a 2-year investigative journey to seek the truth behind all the relics associated with the Passion of the Christ. Now, I can see why that took 2 years, because, you know, you had to find out where the relics were and study and do that. If that book's anything like the Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, it's definitely an investigative journey. And what Górny did was he investigated a rich body of evidence found in museums, archives, and churches surrounding those objects believed to have been preserved since Jesus' lifetime. And he brings in historians and scientists and discusses... their attempts to verify these relics' authenticity. I'm going to have to check that book out for sure. Definitely some Indiana Jones stuff going on here with these books. Extremely interesting to me. I always found that relics to be an interesting thing. They tie us. They ground us back to the people that we read about. objects, clothing, stuff like that. It's just has always been an interest to me. One place that if you haven't been to that's really, really cool is the Bone House in Pittsburgh, St. Anthony's Chapel. It's the largest collection of relics outside the Vatican in the world. And to step inside this place is absolutely amazing. A friend and I went there. We visited with my friend Mike Aquilina. And what an experience to be in that place with the relics of so many holy people. It just blew me away. So another book that Gorney wrote is called Trust. In this one, he's looking at St. Faustina. And again, the illustrations in here they're saying are incredible. And he's following the steps of St. Faustina, moving from place to place in Eastern Europe, such as Krakow, Plock, and Vilnius. And just follow her footsteps, the inspirational visions that brought forth the Divine Mercy devotion, obviously, is one of St. Faustina's keynotes, I guess you would say, to her life and to her mark she left on the world. Another one I'm seeing is Guadalupe Mysteries, Deciphering the Code. So these are just pretty incredible stuff. And in my discovery for more books by him, I found that there's one coming out called Fatima Mysteries, Mary's Message to the Modern Age. That's actually on pre-order right now. So these could keep interested readers busy for some time. One thing I wanted to go over today before we got to Vivian, before she comes on, is two books that have come out recently. The first one is Father Benedict, The Spiritual and Intellectual Legacy of Pope Benedict XVI. If you have any interest in Pope Benedict, this here is a good source. James Day is the author. Sophia Institute Press released it. I'm going to try to get James on so we can talk a little bit about Pope Benedict XVI, a favorite of mine, and a favorite of many. I absolutely love reading Pope Benedict's books. They're a little heavy. You got to take your time with them, but man, what a plethora of books he's written. It would take a lifetime just to study and read and reread and truly understand what some of the things he says. Sometimes it goes a little above me, but great book. And another one here, this one released by Emmaus Road. It's a new one by Mike Aquilina. It's called How the Choir Converted the World Through Hymns, With Hymns, and In Hymns. And what Mike does in this book is he looks at music. Cardinal Worrell says, we all love to sing, to raise our voice in song, even if it's not always in tune. Mike Aquilina walks us through centuries of faith, teaching, doctrine, and spirituality, explaining as we go the significance of music, the value of human song, and the unique power of voices joined in choir. This would be a great gift for your choir director church if you're thinking of looking for something to gift somebody at some point, a birthday or something of that nature. I know we're past Christmas now, but that's going to be an interesting read, I'm sure. There's two new books that are coming out very soon that I want to talk about before we get to our first segment with Ignatius Press editor Vivian Doudreau. And the first book is called Meeting God in the Upper Room. It's by Monsignor Peter Vaggi. And if you're unfamiliar with Monsignor Vaggi, he has written a series of books that were really influential in me early on in the years of reviewing because, you know, I'm a convert, as I've said before. I went through sort of a dark, unmotivated spell on my Catholicism for a number of years. But when I got back into the faith, this was set that he wrote was one of the ones that was very, very, it was a guiding to me. And there's a reason for that. The set that he wrote is called the Pillars of Faith series. And it's a series of four books, and they're catechism-based. They're a catechetical series that is directly meant to help RCIA candidates in their faith formation. It's concise. It's really accessible. And they go through four different volumes that have four pillars of the faith, thus their name. The first one, The Faith We Profess, a Catholic Guide to the Apostles' Creed. The second one was The Sacraments We Celebrate, a Catholic Guide to the Seven Mysteries of Faith. The third one, The Commandments We Keep, a Catholic Guide to Living a Moral Life. And the fourth one, The Prayer We Offer, a Catholic Guide to Keeping to Communion with God. Great introductory set to the faith. So whether you're just becoming exposed to Catholicism, if you've been a Catholic for a while, and even if you're a cradle Catholic looking for a refresher, this was a great series. But the new book he has coming out is called Meeting God in the Upper Room, Three Moments to Change Your Life. And this is based off a Holy Land pilgrimage that Monsignor made, where he explores three significant events in the life of the early church. And all three of these can be traced back to the Upper Room in Jerusalem. And the book's divided into three parts dedicated, each of those dedicated to one of those key moments that he has used for the book. It's called, they are the Last Supper and the Institution of the Eucharist, the post-resurrection appearances of Christ to his followers, and the Holy Spirit descending on the apostles of Pentecost. I'm really looking forward to that book, and I can't wait to get my hands on it, and maybe even have Monsignor on the show. Who knows? So with that, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be with Vivian Doudreau. She's the editor for Ignatius Press that worked on the book, Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, The Secrets of Christmas and Epiphany. You're listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox, and you're listening to Breadbox Media. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. I'm Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger, and today we're talking with Vivian Doudreau about Ignatius Press's release, Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, The Secrets of Christmas and Epiphany. Welcome to the show, Vivian.
Thank you.
So let's talk a little bit about the book. First of all, this is my first encounter with author Gregorz Górny. Hopefully I didn't butcher that name. So can you tell us a little bit about him and you know, any other past books he had and what brought this book to be?
He's a journalist from Warsaw, Poland, and he has teamed up with Janusz Rosikon, a Polish photographer. Janusz has founded Rosikon Press in Poland, in Warsaw. And these two have teamed up to make what I'm calling the National Geographic version of Catholic books, because they're lavishly illustrated on every page with four color photographs. Many of these have been taken by the photographer Rosikon.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to mention about the book while we're talking about it is, It's a beautiful book. I mean, you know, it's packed with good information, but it's really the photos, the artwork. It's a pretty awesome looking book.
Yes. So Rosikon approached us to do English translations of the books they're producing on Catholic subjects, and this one, Three Kings, Ten Mysteries. This is about the fourth book we've done with them. We've also produced Trust, which is about St. Faustina, and one on Guadalupe, the image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and Christ's Relics of the Passion. So they have a particular interest in, you know, kind of the supernatural, the intersection, if you will, of the supernatural in our lives and some of these mysterious things. They like to explore, you know, what's worthy of belief and what isn't, and what do we just have to like shrug our shoulders and say, well, maybe not.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to have to check out those other three. I was very impressed with this. Now, is Gregorz the author of those three as well?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. He wrote all of these books, and Janusz Rosikon is the photographer for most of the images in all of these books as well.
Nice. So let's take a little bit of a look at the subject matter itself, and that's the Three Kings. As we're recording this, this Sunday will be the Epiphany. This show will probably be broadcast in a week or two, so the Epiphany will be passed, but it's still a subject we can talk about anytime. One of the things that's brought up in the foreword of the book, and I thought was an interesting point and a true point, is why do some people have this feeling that the Three Kings weren't real? They were only a legend, and they're not historical figures.
Well, the starting point for that doubt, I think, is the modern era that gave us modern biblical scholarship that began to apply very rigid standards for belief, which were, if we can't prove it with certitude, we can't believe it. And so this approach to the scriptures has, you know, over the years debunked and demythologized just about everything there is in the scriptures, because very little of it, none of it, can probably be proved with certitude apart from, yes, there is a town of Bethlehem because it's still there, and there is a city of Jerusalem and things like this. But so this debunking, this demythologizing of the scriptures, which has gone on now for, you know, 100 years, I think has made people, assume that these are just fairy tales, right? That they aren't worthy of belief. And so the author, Mr. Gorney, his approach is, really? Is that really true? Are the Gospels really thoroughly and utterly debunked and we can't believe anything? Or is there some probing that could be done and we could maybe find some historical, archaeological, and so on, bits and pieces here and there that might reconvince us that while we can't prove everything with certitude, there's maybe more that we can know than we thought. And maybe that's worth looking at and thinking about.
Yes, indeed. Now, and what I found interesting and what may lead to some of that is, you know, the Three Kings or the Magi or whatever verbiage you want to use to describe these three gentlemen, they're only mentioned briefly in the Gospel. So that had to be a challenge for Mr. Gorney to formulate this book if, you know, we're talking about an entity, a person, a people's. They're only briefly mentioned, yet they play a significant role in the nativity story. So what sources outside of Scripture did Mr. Gorney have to rely on to make this book?
Well, I would even back up just a little bit and start with the Gospel itself and say, why should we believe the Gospel at all? You know, whether the mention is brief or long, why believe any of it? And I think the starting point for us should be that something profound must have happened to the apostles and the gospel writers to have changed their lives in such an important way that they not only recorded these events and spread these stories, but in many cases died for Christ. Something big happened, and shouldn't we take seriously this record, at least with a starting point of, you know, we should take these men seriously. We'll try to find out what their purpose might have been in writing this down. Now, I suppose you could say, well, they were frauds. You know, what they wrote down was just made up so that they could dupe people into, I don't know, following them, giving them money, giving them power or whatever. And while that might be true with some founders of some religions, it's certainly not the case with what happened to the apostles of Christ, as we know. So, and then I think we should add to this taking seriously what might have happened to Matthew or Mark or Luke or John or Peter or Paul or any of them. I think we also have as a starting point those of us who have faith, who have encountered Christ, who have been transformed by this relationship. We might wish that it were a bigger transformation than it actually is. However, there's evidence, I think, in our own lives, you know, that something mysterious is actually going on in this relationship between us and God. I think if you start there, you now have a more open mind to exploring, as Mr. Gorney does. I think he's a man of faith, so I think he starts out with an open mind. So your question, well, what other sources besides the Gospels does he look at? Well, there were other documents written at the time of Christ or shortly thereafter, historical, for example, the Jewish historian Josephus, his works are still in existence. They describe King Herod in great detail. It matches up pretty nicely with the villain in the Gospels. There's coins that were minted with people's names on them. These places are still on the map. You can go and visit them. There was a caste, if you will, of people called Magi in the ancient world in Persia, Babylonia. These men were basically the scientists of their era, right? They studied the heavens with pretty sophisticated equipment and formulations, and they so much so sophisticated that you could navigate ships by astronomy. The pyramids were built with the use of astronomy. So there's enough in history, I think, to demonstrate that these people could very well have studied the heavens, studied sacred writings, come to the conclusion that something was going on in Judah, and it might just be worth a visit to King Herod to find out what it is. It can't be proved, but it's not a completely crazy, outlandish story.
So you're telling me they didn't have GPS back then? Just kidding.
Yeah, no. In fact, they probably don't get as lost as often as we do. You know, the more we rely on GPS systems and algorithms to tell us what to do, I think often the more we're cut off from the reality right under our nose, you know?
Right, right. So we have a couple minutes left in this segment. I just wanted to briefly touch on, in the first, you know, the book's divided into 10 mysteries, and when we come back, we'll get into a deeper discussion about that. But the first one's about Matthew, the gospel writer himself, and the fact that Matthew himself is kind of a mystery, himself, because the only thing we really know about Matthew is he was a tax collector, he was called by Christ, and after that, he's not really mentioned that much in Scripture, and we really don't have that much knowledge about him. So, you know, again, that adds to your thought of the question of is the gospel legit? So what are your thoughts on Matthew, the mysterious apostle?
Well, you know, from other Bible scholars, we know that the gospels, all four of them, have more credibility than Caesar's Gallic Wars. And nobody runs around questioning whether or not there was a Julius Caesar or whether or not he fought in Gaul or whether or not he, we just totally take for granted that these characters from our history books are real people. But when it comes to the Gospels, you know, suddenly we're dubious and, you know.
Everybody wants to challenge it.
Yes. And so, yes, you're right. Matthew sort of slips into obscurity apart from the Gospel that bears his name. I mean, that's still extant to this day. I mean, that, you know, how many people from that time have any trace left of them at all? I mean, it's kind of remarkable that we even know this person named Matthew at all, never mind the little that we know. You know, the focus is on the wrong thing. You know, the focus is on what we don't know instead of the amazing little tidbit that we do still know.
Let's take a brief break, and we'll be back. You're listening to Off the Shelf, and my guest, Vivian Dudrow from Ignatius Press. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. I'm your host, Pete Sox. We've been here with Vivian Dudrow from Ignatius Press, and we're talking about their latest book, Three Kings, Ten Mysteries by Gregors Gorney. We left off last segment talking about the first mystery, in the book, and that is about the Matthew and his gospel. And that title of that chapter was The Phantom Apostle. So we're talking a little bit about the the question of, you know, Matthew being hidden and whatnot all. And I didn't know if you had anything else you wanted to add. We cut that last segment off there at the end pretty quick.
No, I don't have anything more to add unless you have a specific question.
No, we can move on here. I wanted to kind of hit through, at least highlight each of these 10 mysteries so people have an idea of just how good this book really is, because it covers a lot of stuff. And, you know, it's the three magi, the three kings. You think it was a little small niche of the entire gospel story, but, you know, this book really opens it up and reveals a lot, I think. And I think it's a very worthy read that people should take advantage of. So the second chapter is called The Gospel's Veracity. And, you know, we did talk about that a little bit already. We talked about the validity of the gospels in the first segment. So one thing we haven't talked about is the next chapter, and that's chapter 3, the Messianic prophecies. And, you know, there's a ton of them out there. People have talked about them. You know, they're Old Testament prophecies about the Messiah coming, and modern scholars dive into that and discover a lot. And we're still discovering some things about those prophecies. So can we touch base on that a little bit? What does this chapter hold for readers?
Yeah, sure. Well, for me, the surprising thing about this chapter is that the sacred writings of the Jews were known by learned peoples in the ancient world, either the Mesopotamian Fertile Crescent part of the world, because of the period that the Jews spent in Babylon. And that, as we know from the Old Testament, you know, the Jewish young men who end up at court with King Nebuchadnezzar, and Cyrus, the king of Persia, when the Persians take over, you know, he lets the Jews go back to rebuild their temple. So it sort of broadened my view of the Messianic prophecies being deposited in these other civilizations. And so when these magi, astronomers, whatever they are, these wise guys, are looking at the heavens and following the courses of the planets and so on, and certain things start to happen, they do, in fact, have the ability to put together that this is linked somehow with the fate of the Jews. And so for me, that was really fascinating.
That they were able to take it to that extent, like, aha, I mean, you know, this is happening.
Right. That they could have deduced from what they were observing that there was a new king in Israel.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned something there, you know, as an offhand in what you're saying is Magi are kings, that's chapter 4. So who were these, you know, three men, you know, they where exactly did they come from? I think the chapter does a good job on that. What are your thoughts on that? Who are the Magi?
Well, again, you know, they were at the courts of the ancient rulers in the Mesopotamian lands, you know, Babylon and then later Persia. And these were men who were the scientists of their day who, you know, read the signs in nature and tried to give good advice to their sovereigns, you know, as far as, you know, auspicious times for invading your neighbors or taking a journey or anything like this. I mean, there was such a class of men that were called magi, and their familiarity with history, and as I say, the history even of the Jewish people, because of time at which the Jews were in exile. This is all very interesting that these men are not just, you know, invented out of thin air, that there were such people at the time of Christ.
Right. I want to dovetail a little bit off of that. This comes from the chapter on the Magi. It's on page 62. It goes into what Pope Benedict the 16th has to say about the Magi. And I'm a big fan of Pope Benedict, so always like reading his stuff, and when I see it, like to hone in on what he's saying. So the paragraph says, today, the three Magi are venerated in the Catholic Church as the patron saints of travelers, pilgrims, merchants, innkeepers, and farriers. Pope Benedict XVI assessed their significance thus. We could well say that they represent the religions moving toward Christ, as well as the self-transcendence of science toward him. In a way, they are the successors of Abraham, who set off on a journey in response to God's call. In another way, they are the successors of Socrates and his habit of questioning above and beyond conventional religion toward the higher truth. In this sense, these figures are forerunners, preparers of the way, seekers after truth, such as we find in every age. I thought that was some pretty powerful writing from our former Pope Benedict XVI.
Yes, these figures are not only are they whoever they were in fact, but they're also representative of the human desire for truth, right? We're all wired to try to find the truth, and when we find it, conform ourselves to it, be transformed by it. This is how we're made. And it's really only in the modern age that we have this attitude that there is no truth, that there's no point in looking for it. It's all, everything's relative. Things don't have any meaning. It's just randomly moving molecules. So who cares? I mean, this is such an utterly, thoroughly modern mentality that has blocked so many people from higher truths that could give their lives meaning and purpose, but even robbed people of their sanity, because, you know, the definition of mental illness is detachment from reality. And if your starting point is there is no reality, I mean, you're already starting off on the wrong foot there. You're not going to get any closer to reality if your starting point is the belief that there is none to be found, you see? And so the wise men, the magi who go in search of truth, in search of wisdom, they're, as I say, not only whoever it was they really were, but they're representative of sort of the highest aspirations of a human being. And we should see them not just as trite little cartoon characters on Christmas cards or figurines in a crush display. We should see them as truly inspiring figures of people of high purpose and people that we would want to imitate.
You know, as we're talking more about the Magi and we go into chapter 5, where the topic is the Magi's homeland, this I thought was a really fascinating chapter, because to me, you always hear the three wise men, three Magi coming from the East, and I automatically think, you know, Oriental, China, that type of thing. But, you know, there's a line in here or a paragraph somewhere, and I can't get my fingers on it right now, where they talk about East is relative to your locale. So who really knows where East is?
Well, we know what's east of Bethlehem and Jerusalem, right? So, I mean, coming from the East, these would be men who traveled east, you know, which would be, in fact, Babylon and Persia, and, you know, which is now modern day, you know, Iraq and so on, right? So that is east of Israel, these places. And but how far east, you know? Yeah, keep going and you will reach China. I don't know. We don't know exactly where these men came from, but we do know that the tradition of the Magi, as I say, was in these countries which are now today Syria and Iraq and Iran. I mean, that's where these fellows most likely came from. And it's interesting that they went to Herod first, right? Because and that Herod returns to the messianic prophecies himself, because the Magi arrive saying, you know, we saw a star and we've interpreted it to mean there's a new king. And it's Herod who turns to his wise men and says, where is the Messiah to be born? That's why the Magi are directed to Bethlehem, because that's in the Old Testament prophecy that the Savior, Messiah, King would be born in Bethlehem. So, you know, there's a lot of drama going on here. As we know, Herod has the children killed, you know, the boys. You know, I mean, there's a lot of drama going on here of the Word of God trying to break into the world, truth seekers trying to find it, and those who are against God trying to destroy it.
Who are against God and more worried about their own legacy and power, which is the case of King Herod. I mean, right. There's a chapter covered on Herod, and you know, he's a pretty bad dude. I mean,
he is a villain with a capital V. Yes, and that was another chapter I found really fascinating, because that does rely upon you know, pretty precise historical records written by historians of that time of just what kind of man he was, what his court was like. And I found that very fascinating.
I'll tell you what, we'll come back to that here after the break, and we'll cover that. We might skip around here in the last couple chapters so we can squeeze as much in as we can. So you've been listening to Off the Shelf, and we'll be right back.
If you like what you're hearing, become a friend of the show. Visit redboxmedia.com and click Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Welcome back. You've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox. We've been chatting with Vivian Doudreau about the book 10 Kings, 10 Mysteries from Ignatius Press. We left off last segment talking about a pretty posturous man, a villain with a capital V, as Vivian said, and she wasn't talking about herself, she was talking about King Herod. And that's chapter 9 of the book. And let's talk about King Herod a little bit, about just how terrible of a person he really was, without a better way of saying that.
Well, and also, interestingly enough, talking about those scripture debunkers earlier, they used to use King Herod as proof that Jesus couldn't have been born when the Gospels say that he was born. But I think Mr. Gorney does a good job of showing that that's not really the case, that if you look at the historical records in another light with other experts, you'll see that the dates do line up, that his reign does line up with what the church believes was the time Christ was born, and that he was indeed a historical figure. His reign and the kind of man he was recorded in detail by the historian Josephus. And, yeah, he makes King Henry VIII look like a Boy Scout, you know. I mean, you know, really a tyrant, probably in the end there, sure sounds like he's riddled with venereal disease and probably made him mad, you know, in the head as well. And really, really wretched man.
I mean, you almost have to be to be that possessed with power that you can't put your finger on the person or the child that you think is going to grow up to be your rival, your enemy for power, that you're that bent on destroying him that you say, okay, fine, I can't find him.
To just slaughter an entire town and its surrounding, slaughter all the children under a certain age. And that's the other interesting thing, too. The age of Jesus at the time that Herod sends his soldiers, because, you know, the wise men do not show up at the creche, right? At the stable. Here's another thing that Bible debunkers used to say. Oh, it says that Jesus was born in a stable over here, but it says that the wise men came to a house over here. That's a contradiction. The Bible's full of contradictions. Can't believe that, right? Well, the wise men did not show up at the stable. In fact, it wasn't until Christ's birth that whatever they saw in the heavens, they saw and then set out on their journey. So it wasn't, you know, immediately after Jesus's birth that the Magi appear. They went on a journey and appeared sometime later. And by then, Mary and Joseph and the Christ child were living in someone's house, you know. And so what was once called a contradiction turns out not to be a contradiction, turns out to be just a different version of the story that happens to focus on different details.
Right, correct. Now, you talked a little bit about that little scenario there. Another thing that's in chapter six that really wasn't even a thought in my mind until reading Pope Benedict the 16th, third volume of the Jesus of Nazareth, his three book series, is the birth date of Jesus. When Benedict brought that up in that book, everybody's like, whoa, you know. So can we talk a little bit about Jesus' birth date and what the author Gregory has to say about it?
Well, we know that the church decided to set Christmas on December 25th for all kinds of reasons, but not because we knew the exact date of when Jesus was born, right? I mean, we no one knows the exact date of when Jesus was born, but it does seem that based on what knowledge can be had, it is likely that he was born in the winter. There's lots of reasons for it to be toward the end of December. That's when the winter solstice is. That's when people were already sort of celebrating the return of the light. You know, after the shortest day of the year, the days get longer, right? And the light gets stronger. And so Jesus is the light of the world and so on. So there's lots of layers to this. But what amazes me is that, you know, the more we find out what little we can scientifically of these things, the more we see that the church was wise all along, that its intuitive understanding of God and of the needs of mankind and so on, the church has been right all along. That to me gives me great comfort in hanging in there with the church.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, we find that time after time. I mean, just like you were talking about last segment about, you know, people trying to debunk gospels and stuff. You know, it's in this whole movement of relativism in our society today. They can talk all they want, but the bottom line is the church isn't wrong. The church is right. It's always been right. It's whether you choose to believe it or not. So the person that's really wrong is the one interpreting it.
Right. And of course, you know, we know that people often turn on the church because of bad examples, you know, Catholics who have set bad examples of, and then, you know, then people throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? And so when we talk about the wisdom of the church, we're not saying that every Catholic is a good one or a wise person or a reliable person, but what we're saying is that the wisdom of this accumulated wisdom of people who've kept the light burning of faith, that accumulated wisdom really is something you can build your life on. That's what's reliable. And, you know, don't let the bad apples in the basket,
yeah,
you know, get you down, right?
Right.
That's the whole story. So, anyway.
So, you know, the book, we obviously are looking at the three kings, and it focuses on the event of Epiphany, the Feast of Epiphany, and there's some history to that feast, which is covered in the last chapter of the book. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Feast of the Epiphany was traditionally when gifts were given because of the gifts brought by the three kings. It's actually one of the oldest feasts in the church because it's very important in the Eastern Church, because the word Epiphany means what? Manifestation, meaning God was manifested to the whole world for the first time. When these pagan wise men come from the east, as we've said before, you know, when the angels announce the birth of the Savior to the shepherds, you know, think of that as telling the local yokels, you know. But when the wise men appear in Bethlehem and are acknowledging Christ's identity, this was looked upon as a really big deal and was celebrated very early on as very important.
Right. Now, I'm going to backtrack a little bit, bounce around this last couple chapters of the book just because we're getting short on time. You know, the chapter on the mysteries of secrets of Bethlehem, I thought was a really neat chapter just because of all the pictures. Not that it had more pictures than any other one, but, you know, it had the plan of the church around the nativity and just, I'm gonna say again, the pictures in this book are just really cool. It brings a whole other aspect into the book, and I got to commend the author and the photographer and Ignatius Press for putting this book together in English. So it was a good it's a good accomplishment, I think, and I'm looking forward to seeing the other three volumes that you have out there. On the Secrets of Bethlehem, what are some of these secrets that Gorney covers?
Well, that's a good question. Well, first of all, it's there. You know, the town is really there, and the town is in the Messianic prophecies. And there are sites within Bethlehem that are considered sacred places. For example, the birthplace of Jesus, there is a basilica built over the place that has been revered for a very long time as the place where Jesus was born. You know, can that be known for certain that this is the place where Jesus was born? You know, I don't know. But when something has been revered for as long as these places have, the earliest centuries of Christianity, and even through Muslim rule and all these other kinds of things, they go into that in the book. These holy places kept, you know, preserved. You know, it's a powerful thing. It really is a powerful thing. I know the first time we took a pilgrimage to Compostela, you know, Santiago de Compostela, and there's this piece of marble that people have put their hands on when the pilgrims first arrived to the church. They put their hand up on this piece of stone. And this piece of stone has been touched by so many hands over so many hundreds of years that the fingers have actually rubbed the stone. There's like finger imprints where the stone has been rubbed. There's just something so powerful about a place that has been venerated by Christians for centuries, especially for us Americans, where, you know, we've only been a nation for a little more than 200 years. I mean, 200 years is a drop in the bucket compared to the 2,000 years plus of Christian faith. And so these holy sites, yes, when you look at a book like this with all these lovely pictures, don't you want to go?
Oh,
you
yeah.
Want to go to the,
I was
going to
mention
the Holy
that.
Land. You want to make pilgrimage yourself to
right.
The Holy Land.
Yeah, and that's another key thing in the book. It's bringing it to you. You know,
it to you.
Right.
Yes.
Yep. So not everybody's going
to
be able to
do it. Hopefully whetting your appetite to want to go to these holy places, because these places have been made holy by the veneration of the faithful for more than 1,000 years. I mean, that's mind-boggling in and of itself. And you know, whether or not it's the real place almost doesn't even matter anymore. We know that the real place exists somewhere. It's like where Jesus was crucified, right? That's definitely in the historical records. He was crucified under Pontius Pilate, you know. Pilate's in the record. And, you know, I don't know. You go to these places and it's a very powerful experience. And that's exactly what the author of this book did, right? He went to these places and saw these things for himself. And
exactly. And brought them to us. And we thank you, Ignatius Press, for doing that. And Vivian, with that, we are out of time today. I want to thank you so much for spending time with us and talking about this great book, Three Kings, Ten Mysteries.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure, and I'm glad you're as excited about it as I am.
Okay, so with that, folks, you've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, the Catholic book blogger. If you want to visit my site at www.catholicbookblogger.com, you'll see the review for Three Kings, Ten Mysteries, other reviews, and weekly giveaways each week. So until next time, God bless.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.